As the miles rolled on beneath his feet, he was surprised to find that those he pursued had not stopped with the setting sun, but had continued on long into the night. Finally, he spotted their campfire on a distant hill to the south. The ground was more broken now, for he had entered the foothills of the Belton Buckle. Exhausted and hungry, Branson still did not stop until he had drawn very near, almost to the base of the round hillock.
No, please! Please leave me be!
You belong to me now, wench! I'll take you as I want!
Me husband!
Dead and pecked by the crows!
Branson crept up the side of the hill as fast as he dared, trying to remain silent and unnoticed. For there were others up there, he realized, and the top of the hill was bare of trees or any other cover he could discern. Flat on his belly, he crawled along. He peered over the hill and spotted them off to the side behind the two burning campfires where they lay behind a log, the man atop the woman having finished his deed. But Branson could hardly look that way, more surprised to see other women and children all about the place. Some curled on the ground and sleeping, others milling about, their eyes vacant, their faces and hair filthy with soot and mud. Branson found it hard to breathe. Across the way, the rapist stood and brushed himself off, then kicked the prone woman and spat upon her.
Oh, here now, don't do that. My turn with her.
The man headed over toward the log, opening his belt as he went, and no one seemed to pay him any heed at all.
And if you try to run again, we'll do worse, don't you doubt?
He kicked her again for good measure, and moved back to the main camp. Branson couldn't comprehend the scene before him. He tried hard to keep his wits about him, to take a measure of the opposing force. He noted only three men, the ones he had seen from the keep wall. Then he spotted a fourth coming up over the back crest of the hillock with an armload of wood.
This is not your fight. You can't save the world, fool. It's all beyond you. There is no point.
He almost convinced himself to walk away. So despondent was Branson that he nearly surrendered there and then to the darkness. Before he had even finished that internal battle, fate mercifully intervened, for a girl spotted him and pointed. He noted the man behind the log scramble up from the beaten woman, hiking his pants as he went. He noted the previous attacker reaching down to grab a short bronze sword as the man with the armload of wood dropped it all except for two sturdy little clubs, one of which he tossed to the fourth man. Branson walked in. They obviously didn't recognize him as the highwayman. He wasn't wearing his distinctive one-sleeved shirt or telltale mask.
Leave her alone.
What clan are ye? Your foolishness is in ye to think you can walk into Clan Huard. Get ye gone!
Clan? I see four ruffians and a score of helpless prisoners.
Some of his bluster was lost as he spoke the words, though, as the young girl who had spotted him ran over to the man with the sword and hid behind him.
What is this? Was that your village?
He tells you to leave.
No, but he ain't going nowhere. He'll just come back for us with his friends.
The man with the sword moved toward Branson's left flank. Of more concern, though, was the man who had just started with a woman. He reached down and produced a bow and arrow.
Look to the trees, fathers!
All the women, save the one on the ground, and all the children rushed to different points along the hilltop and peered down into the darkness.
Now you tell us who you are.
I am Branson Garibond of Pridetown, son of Bran Dinard, of the Order of Abel and of Senwi, who is Jester too. None of that means anything to you, I am sure, except that you know of Pridetown.
You fight for King Yezelnik!
I fight for no one.
I'm not thinking that's true.
The sword wielder gave a slight nod at the archer, a movement Branson caught clearly so that he was not surprised when the archer let fly an arrow. He snapped his left forearm straight up and ducked, deflecting the arrow high where it flew away into the darkness. All at once, the other three charged. The swordsman was closest, blade leading. As soon as Branson turned toward him, he cowardly skidded to a stop and fell back a step. Branson turned back to meet the two others, who were swinging their clubs with abandon. Both men went down in a matter of seconds and Branson retrieved a club. Branson turned fast to meet the charge of the swordsman. He heard the bow fire behind him and instinctively dove diagonally down and to the right. Branson went right through a roll and back to his feet, barely two strides from his enemy. Instead of lifting the club to block, he tossed it up into the air. The swordsman's eyes reflexively followed the ascent, and he looked back just in time to see Branson lunging forward. Branson went down low, almost to all fours, cleverly scooping a stone. He came up straight again and looked at his foe's leveled bow.
You have only one shot, of course.
Branson smiled and began to walk steadily at the bowman.
Perhaps you will kill me, though I think that unlikely.
Branson hopped left, hopped right, and threw the rock. The bowman let fly, but he was ducking as he did. Then the archer was fleeing. Branson turned to face his previous attackers. The swordsman swayed as he stood there, his face bloody, his eyes already swelling from a brutal punch. The club wielders were still down.
Is this a dance you truly desire?
Who are you?
I already told you.
Why are you here?
Curiosity and disgust.
Disgust? Have you seen our homes? Have you seen me kinsmen? 8 of them trampled death under the spinning wheels of a chariot.
I will go my way. And if you try to stop me again, or if I see you mistreating your own again like the dogs of war, I will kill you.
With that, Branson turned and went off into the woods. By the time he dared stop, the campfire in the hillock was a distant speck of light. The troubled young man sat back against a tree trunk, shifting so that his vantage point gave him a clear view of the starry sky. Were these people so desperate, so out of sorts, that such behavior had become acceptable to them? Was their loss so profound to their sensibilities that any semblance of order, even if it was order under the stamp of a heavy and painful boot, brought a measure of security and comfort? He stared up at the stars, and he shook his head at the helpless futility of it all. He slept there, up in the tree, exhausted from his ordeal, and from, most of all, the emotional battering he had taken in the shock of the cruel reality. He awoke before dawn and began the long walk back to the northern fork that would lead him to Pridetown, and north beyond that, he hoped, to Chapel of Bell and Kaydale.
Not as secure as you insisted.
King Yezelnik scolded Laird Panlemaris when the truth of the murderous knight became evident across the city.
What do you know of Powrys? You ever fight one? You ever stick your sword into one's gut, tearing out its innards and thinking your battle done, only to have the beast laugh at ye and leap on ye?
Aye,
but it's a dactyl demon itself the witch Gwydra's put upon my city and upon us all. Don't you doubt it, King Yezelnik. The Powrys are more than Palmaris Town's problem.
And what will you do about our problem? Your city has a most important guest, the king himself. And you allow these beasts to crawl in at night and cause such mischief?
No warships in port this night. The Powrys come from the river, and so the river will be watched.
See to it that they do not return until my own ship is long gone from your wharf.
Aye, my king.
They called it Sepulchre. To the Powrys, this was procreation, and for hundreds of years it had been the only means of continuing their race. McGuigic and Bicklebrin and the others took the hearts of their fallen comrades and buried them, then danced their magical movements and sang their songs, invoking the healing powers of the world to breathe life into those hearts anew. In a matter of weeks, a new Powry would emerge from the shallow graves, small at first, but fast to grow into the image of the one who had provided the heart. McGuigic led the songs, the first of which spoke of times long past when the bloody-capped dwarves dominated Corona. Numbering in the millions, their kingdoms ruled supreme in every land from Bear to Elpinador and on the islands across the Great Mirianic. Even those places now considered wilderness, like this very region across the Mazer Delaval, had been, according to Powry lore, once tamed under the armies of the dwarves. But Sepulchre, for all of its rejuvenating magic, was a practice of inevitable decline. Any dwarf lost whose heart could not be reclaimed could not be replaced. What's more, Sepulchre produced only male Powrys. Even a female dwarf heart would yield a male child, one that looked much like its predecessor, but was undeniably male. The dwarves had never been prolific breeders in the traditional sense, and, alas, there remained no female Powrys to be found in any event. This was the lament of the songs as the dwarves, locked in a huddle, arms across each other's shoulders, moved to the second act of their ritual. The lament drifted to the recitation of heroic feats of heart retrieval. mostly at sea, as the determined dwarves steadfastly refused to let their race pass from the world. Among the Powrys, no hero stood taller than those who would dive into the cold waters to secure the lines to a sunken barrel boat and her lost crew. The final act was a call to the Powry gods to grant a woman from the sepulchre, and was followed by the melodic and droning song of the warrior, the final resigned acceptance.
Aye, but they're coming.
All eyes turned to the wide river. In an ultimate act of defiance, the Powrys had decided to create their mass sepulchre directly across the river from Palmaris town on the western bank of the Maesur Delaval, and in full view of the city lights across the way.
They'll find their boys!
Nay, but the dopes ain't for knowing nothing about the sepulchre.
Yeah, but what's yourselves knowing about what they're knowing? You've been on a damned island for 100 years! I'm knowing that if they knew, they'd cut the hearts after staking our boys. Cut them and burn them, and we'd be down a fair number of dwarves.
Aye, mess it all up then, and no cairns. If they're not knowing that we buried something here, they'll not be looking.
Summer's on, ground's soft. Not hard to see that the ground's been turned.
Picklebren grinned wickedly and looked to McWiggick, and then the two of them turned to Shicknickel.
So we buried our waste, eh? Digged them holes back halfway to the heart. Had a hearty dinner myself.
That was all he needed to say. The dwarves excavated 2 feet of dirt. As was customary in sepulchre, the hearts were down twice that. The dwarves did their business, laying a layer of shite into the holes once they were opened. Then they filled the holes, scraped the ground, and tossed stones and branches about haphazardly.
As fitting a cairn as any powered air want.
But ain't far. Arrows will be flying in soon.
The Powrys retreated up the riverbank to the north, where they had beached their barrel boats. They didn't immediately climb aboard and put back out, though, for the sailing ships didn't hang around on that side of the river for long. The dark of night favored the Powrys, who could see the silhouette of sails clearly enough against the starry canopy, while their barrel boats would be almost completely invisible to sailors on Palmaris Town ships. More than one of Shicknickel's boys pointed that out as they watched from a rocky point. They were hungry for revenge and eager to ram a few warships after burying the hearts of their fallen. Shicknickel held them back.
Boats are already out, peddling across the gulf. Our boys will be paid in full order, and soon enough, when all the boats of the isles come forth. Oh, but there's a human blood to be spilling, don't you doubt? And I'm telling me own shiver to know that they're killing more than any others.
You do wrong by me, King Yezelnik.
Father de Gilb protested at a private meeting between himself and the ruling couple.
To associate me with Artelevan and his ilk insults me profoundly.
I have done you wrong.
You look upon me with contempt, as does your wife. I see it, and I do not blame you at all, given the horrible treatment the Order of Abel has shown to you. You scarcely looked at me on the docks other than a single sneer.
You would elevate yourself to the level of Laird Panlamaris, then? Or that of his son, who conquered a third of Haunts in my name? You believe that you, a monk who no longer even has Artelevan's ear, is as important to me as those two?
More important. An army might win a man's body by either breaking it wholly or forcing him to inaction. No doubt your great armies will sweep the land with the banners of King Yezelnik and Delaval City, but it is the church, and not the state, that keeps peasants truly in line. Would you have your entire reign be a matter of destroying one revolt after another?
You presume much.
I have seen much. The folk of Haunts, of any land, need the reassurance that their miserable existence will lead them to some place better. They need hope in eternal life and justice. The Samhastes provided that, albeit harshly, but they are of little consequence now. Because of the war, because of the healing powers of our gemstones, the Order of Abel has become ascendant. We are the guardians of eternity, and the partner you will need if you hope to keep the peasants in line.
I mean to kill Father Artelevan. You do understand that, I hope.
I would kill him myself if the opportunity ever arose.
He wants Chapel Abel for himself.
Ah.
We cannot wait for Chapel Abel to fall.
We?
You have already announced that you will march to Ethelbert's gates first. You will tame the land around Chapala Bell to isolate Artilevan and Gwydra and their traitorous followers. You will not return before the end of summer, surely, and you will not camp your army on the field throughout the Haunt's winter. Nor do I expect defeating the chapel will come easily if you assembled 100,000 strong warriors for the task. Her walls are thick and tall, and her brothers skilled at the use of gemstone magic, as Laird Pan Lamaris will surely attest.
He doesn't believe in you, my great king.
Your assault will not begin within a year, and I fear it may be several more before you finally break through those walls and expel the traitors. You do not have several years. The peasants will need reassurance. They need to believe that their eternal...
Laird Pan Lamaris has already told me of your wishes to be instilled as an alternative father of the older.
His wishes as well. He understands the need.
And I do not?
I would never hint at such a thing, my king. I am well known among the brothers of Abel. When I was selected to travel to Alpinador those years ago, every brother in the Order heard my name, and they knew it even before that time, during the years when I was a leading master at Chapel Abel. More than a few of my brethren understand, as do I, that Father Artilevan's decision to walk a neutral line in the greatest war Hans has ever known was a fool's errand. Wars have winners and losers, and it has been clear from the beginning that Delaval City would become the center of Haunts, and her laird the new king of the land. I argued for such as soon as I returned from my adventures in the north. I told Artilevan to follow your edict to its fullest extent, with great hope that the war would then soon end, and you could assume leadership over the unified kingdom.
Perhaps you are not as influential as you believed, eh?
Not with Artilevan's minions at Chapel Abel, and certainly not with Dame Gwydra and her followers. If ever there was an argument against allowing a woman to preside over a holding, Dame Gwydra is it. You need to give the brothers of the many chapels a choice apart from Father Artilevan. There will be debate in every chapel regarding the edicts of Father Artilevan, and it will oft be contested. If you present an alternative to Artilevan, Father de Gilb of the Chapel of Precious Memories here in Palmaris Town, then those arguments will be less conclusive. More and more brothers will cease to resist you as you sweep the land of all resistance to your inevitable rule. Besides, my king, your ascent is obviously not without the sanction of God.
What do you mean?
Absent God's graces, no man may ever claim such a title. Thus, you are not merely King Yezelnik, but Blessed King Yezelnik.
You really believe that?
It matters not. All that matters for your security and the strength of your kingdom is that the peasants believe it.
Can I trust you, Father de Gilb? I don't even know you.
You can trust the judgment of Laird Pan Lamaris. You can know for certain that I left Chapel Abel in disgust over Father Artilevan's refusal to admit the obvious. That Yezelnik is king of Haunts and that we, his servants, are duty-bound to abide by his edicts. That much, my king, you can verify and trust.
Loyal to me?
Yezelnik held out a large jeweled ring sparkling in the room's torchlight. De Gilb immediately fell to one knee, took up the slight hand, and kissed the ring.
I may decide to move you to Chapel de Laval. It would do well and wise for the seat of the church and state to be near each other, for we need to converse often.
I go where you command.
For now, that would be the Chapel of Precious Memories. Better that you are here, where the common folk are both weary and wary. I'll not return to De Laval City until the ultimate least, so I'll not need you there until then. My subjects of De Laval are very loyal.
I am to claim myself as Father de Gilb of the Chapel of Precious Memories?
I will make that claim for you, of course, and will also declare that the Chapel of Precious Memories serves as a temporary seat of power for the Order of Abel.
Your faith in me is greatly appreciated.
Faith? I will watch you in your new role. If I am pleased, I will formally appoint you the head of the Order of Abel. Your first command from the throne, Father de Gilb, find a new name for your church.
What?
It should have a reference to me in it somewhere.
De Gilb's eyes widened, but he withered under the cold stare of Queen Olim and held silent.
Yes, to the king. The divine king. Surely my ascent is more than an accident. You just said as much.
I said that the peasants needed to believe in such...
Do you not agree?
I... There is a difference between the secular and the spiritual, I believe.
The Brothers of Abel have long claimed a beneficial god, have they not? A shepherd overseeing the flock of man who blesses many with magical healing and other divine gifts if they believe in his way to eternity.
Yes, but...
But, Father, if such a god exists, and you believe he does, then surely his will is involved in settling the outcome of this greatest of conflicts. Hans is unified for the first time, or soon will be. A king will rule Hans for the first time, and that king will be me. If divine providence would play no role in that, then how are we to believe your claims of a god who cares about the plight of his flock? I am not merely a secular king, then. I am a divine king. A divine king who deems your order misguided and nullified, and who, by his graces, restores that order under the watchful eye of Father de Gilb. Perhaps.
The Church of Divine Yezelnik.
Father de Gilb will find the right notes.
Indeed, my king.
Bludgeon them mercilessly.
King Yezelnik spoke to Laird Panlimaris and Prince Milwellis.
Fell every tree between here and Chapel Abel to build your catapults and throw stones and livestock and peasants alike at their walls. Bring them pain. And do not let even one of them escape your web.
The Prince of Palmaristan nodded, quite satisfied with the task put before him.
My ships will secure the river. Let yours secure the gulf. Let us destroy any powries that may still be about, and more importantly, do not allow any to sail out of Chapel Abel's docks.
And none from Vanguard. Oh, but we'll be paying Dame Guidra's ports a visit or 10.
As you will. Your primary duty is to secure the siege of Chapel Abel and to send the wretched powries to cold and watery deaths. If you find the time to harass the minions of Dame Guidra and Vanguard, then go with my blessing.
We should destroy the wench now and be done with her and with those idiot monks.
One snake at a time, one snake at a time. And that snake is Ethelbert. My army swell with the soldiers of the Western Holdings. I will gather Laird Bonnegram in my wake and ride straight to Ethelbert's gates. His city will be mine before Midsummer's Day. Bonnegran will find no more glory than the man who rains punishment upon the treacherous monks in Chapel Abel. Palmaristan will be the second city of Hans, behind De Laval. And it occurs to me that the great Laird Panlimaris' son should not wait for his father's death to find his own holding.
Hear now, my king.
Ethelbert, when I've chased the scum Laird into the Mirianic, his city will need a new Laird. Perhaps your son will be that man. And what a glorious control that would afford both of you of the long coast of Hans.
He approached at night, for he wasn't certain if new residents had come to the house. He expected that some had, given what he had seen in the last miles of his trek. Only 1 year before, the hill upon which this house stood had been the outskirts of Pride Town and afforded a view beyond the borders of civilization. But how the place had grown! Hundreds of new cottages had been constructed, an entire forest had been cleared away, and all for security reasons, Branson realized. None had made a greater name for himself in the miserable war than Laird Bonnegran of Pride, whose garrison had chased Ethelbert's army from the field and rescued many towns from the crush of enemies. When he had come through Pride Town briefly with Jameson, Branson had approached from the north and departed to the east, and in those places, though there were more cottages, the region seemed much the same. But here, across the way, in the southwestern reaches of the hold, the explosion of residents was truly dramatic. Branson noted no candles burning in the house as he climbed the hill. So many memories followed him to the doorstep. The broken door and darkness beyond showed him, to his surprise, that the place had remained deserted. Though whether out of respect for the former residents, fear of some curse because of their apparent fate, or simply because Pride Town's traditional populace had been decimated in the many months of fighting, where so many of her men and women had marched off to battle, he could not tell. This had been the home of Callan Dwarne and her daughter Kaedale. Here Branson, disguised as the highwayman, first courted Kaedale. Here, on this very spot before the door, marked where the highwayman had killed his first enemy, a thug who had come here to do great harm to Kaedale and her mother. A cauldron of emotions filled the young man as he stood staring at the spot where he had killed that young man. His actions had been justified, necessary even, for the sake of the woman, and he felt no remorse for the thug. but in the larger reality of the world that had fallen like a boulder upon him, the sense of futility and ultimate despair colored his every thought. He couldn't escape the sense that the road he had begun that night at this door, the role he had taken on as a defender of some greater sense of justice, seemed naught but folly. Branson walked away. He couldn't smooth the dissonance of his thoughts and feelings. He had done right in coming here to defend Kay Dale and Callan on that long ago night. Of course he had. But to what end? To what point? He thought of Dame Gwydra as he walked across the rolling fields at Pride Holding. The fighting had not come here, other than one small battle, and so the town itself appeared much as it had when Branson had called it home only a year before. Only a year, but it seemed a lifetime to the young man. He could hardly believe the journey physically and emotionally. He had walked from Pride Town to Great Delaval City and up the river to Palmares Town. From there he had gone to Chapel of Bell and across the Gulf of Corona to Vanguard. Pressed into service to the Lady of Vanguard, he had traveled to the wild and frigid land of Alpinador. And all the way back again, across the Gulf to Chapel of Bell, south to Pride Town, and to the far eastern reaches of Hants, to Ethelbert d'Ossentel. Despite the widening boundaries of its cottages and tents, how small Pride Town looked to him now. Branson had spent the entirety of his life here until that fateful night when, in rescuing Kay Dale, he had also brought about the death of Laird Priday. His road had begun with banishment, and in so short a time he had traversed the length and breadth of Hants and more. Was there a man alive more traveled than he? That thought led him back to Jamestown Sequin and the man's tragic fate, all for the crime of escorting Branson to the east. He paused on a hilltop, Castle Pride and Chapel Pride visible in the north, Kay Dale's house behind him in the southwest, and the edges of a small lake visible across the way. There lay his first home, with Garibald Womack, before the ailing and aging man had put him in the service to the brothers at Chapel Pride. So many memories flooded Branson. He tried to put them in context with a new reality that he now understood. There had been very few pleasant times in the years of his youth, but those precious few struck him now. He thought of the many hours sitting by the lake with Garibald while the man fished for their dinner. He remembered, as if it had occurred only the day before, the first time he opened the Book of Jest, the tome copied by his father and protected from the outraged monks by Garibald. He thought of Brother Riandu and his days at the chapel in a cellar hole. How, to keep his sanity then, Branson recreated the Book of Jest, scratching the walls with a stone. His youth had been filled with long hours of grueling work, for even the simplest task had been brutally difficult to the boy known as the Stork, the boy whose muscles would not answer the demands of his mind. His youth had been filled with the torment of the other boys, often brutal and violent. He looked back to the southeast and envisioned the doorway at Kay Dale's old house and thought again of that fateful night when he, the fledgling highwayman, killed his first man. Branson was not proud of that act, was not happy that it had been forced upon him, but he had done a good thing that day. He had acted for justice and for the defense of those who could not defend themselves.
The call of the highwayman.
Branson closed his eyes and pictured Kay Dale's small hand reaching down to him toward the stork who lay in the mud after being decked by more ruffians. There, alone on the hill, he mentally took her outstretched hand and let it lift him once more from the darkness that welled up inside of him since the disaster in Ethelbert, the murder of Jamestown Sequin, the betrayal of Afwin Wee, the loss of his sword and gemstone brooch, and the horrors he had just witnessed in the ravaged Southland. He stood tall on the hill, tall and straight, though he had no hematite, no soul stone to support him. He felt his line of life energy, his Kichi Cree, running solid and strong from his forehead to his groin. He was no more the Stork, and would never again be the Stork. The world around him had gone mad, perhaps, and the terrible events and turmoil were beyond his control. But up there, before the dawn, Branson Womack reminded himself that for most of his life, this simple act of standing straight, of having a measure of discipline over his own body, was all that he wished in the world. The notion brought a smile to his face, but only briefly. He was whole. It was not enough. Though he stood lost, and he knew it. He had found a measure of senselessness to life's journey that mocked the very concept of purpose. He had walked the wider world and found it to be too wide, too uncontrollable, too much a cycle of inevitable misery and grief. He started off the hillock heading for the lake, thinking to look in on the old stone house that had been his home for all of his youth. A small stumble, perhaps an honest trip, confused him and terrified him. He shook his head and started once more, but veered almost immediately, turning toward the north, walking straight for Chapel Pride. He needed to go there, needed to hear the counsel of Master Riandu. Branson, the agnostic, sought some comfort. He walked up the path through Chapel Pride's gate. The front doors were open, a pair of brown-robed monks on the porch sweeping away the leaves. They stopped in unison and leaned on their brooms, watching Branson's approach. One stepped toward the door.
Go and fetch Master Riandu!
You could just take me to his chambers.
Better meet him out here. At first, at least.
In case Bonnegran comes running, you mean? Well, it is a fine day anyway. So better to speak out under the sun.
And so he wasn't surprised to see Bonnegran rushing through the gates of the courtyard before Riandu even made his appearance. The man was not alone, flanked by a dozen warriors armored in bronze and with swords in hand. Bonnegran looked Branson over dismissively.
I have received no word from King Yezlenik that you are pardoned.
Branson didn't answer, seemed as if he did not care.
I warned you about returning here.
I had nothing to do with the death of King Delavor. I was in Alpinador and Vanguard and nowhere near to Delavor City.
So you have claimed before.
I know who killed him.
Bonnegran stood up very straight, his massive and muscled chest straining the straps of his fabulously decorated bronze breastplate.
Branson, what brings you to Pride? Evidence of your innocence?
No.
Where is your proof, boy?
I didn't kill him. I was nowhere near Delavor City.
Who killed him?
A woman. A woman from Bear.
On what proof?
None but my word.
Bonnegran paused for a few heartbeats, looked at Branson, then to Riandu. He turned to his guards.
Take him.
I came to speak with Master Riandu.
If he resists at all, kill him on the spot.
The soldiers fanned out around Branson, iron swords in hand.
Take him!
The soldier to Branson's right lowered his shoulder behind his shield and rushed in suddenly, an obvious path, and one that Branson could have easily sidestepped, but he didn't. He turned back to look plaintively at Master Riandu.
I need to talk with you.
Then the shield slammed against him and sent him flying.
With ease, he is not resisting!
But the soldiers, as if considering the apparent submissiveness to be a dangerous ruse, came on in full.
Bonnegran!
Branson felt himself tugged over to his stomach, his hands wrenched behind his back and bound at the wrists with heavy, coarse rope. From that rope, a second rope was strung, this one wrapping about the front of his waist, holding his hands fast and tight against his back. His captors slid a long pole under his elbows and across his back. A man grabbed each end of the pole and roughly hoisted Branson up from the ground.
Stand!
Branson stumbled to comply, but the man slugged him hard on the back of the head. By then a crowd had gathered outside Chapel Pride's gate.
Clear the way!
He is not resisting, lad Bonnegran.
Riandu's words fell on deaf ears. The soldiers dragged and carried Branson away past Bonnegran, who fixed him with a hateful stare.
Don't kill the boy. He is just a boy.
He said he knows who killed Delavor. That is his only possible salvation.
You will spare him.
It is not my choice to make.
The people of Pride will not forgive you, Laird Bonnegran.
Bonnegran looked at him as if it were foolish for Riandu to even believe that Bonnegran cared.
And you won't forgive yourself.
Bonnegran blinked.
I will attend to him personally, with the Soul Stone.
Once he is secured, you will have your chance to heal the outlaw. The more you heal him, the more we can hurt him without killing him.
The cold and wet, filthy dungeons smelled of death.
I trust that you are comfortable.
The jailers at Castle Pride were well prepared to handle this dangerous man. They had the highwayman chained by his wrists and ankles, the top chains lifting him a couple of feet from the floor by his arms, the bottom set securing his feet with just enough give to allow the ruffians to bow Branson at the waist, wrapping him around a central beam. In deference to the man's inexplicable physical abilities, the jailers had added a devious twist to the harness by cutting a ridge into the center of the beam where his belly rested. Into that ridge they slid a sword blade, edge out, then adjusted the chains to pull Branson snugly into the beam, the blade tightly secured against his belly. Any struggling, indeed, even if he relaxed his weight onto the beam, would surely eviscerate the miserable prisoner.
Have I thanked you for your hospitality?
You appreciate your accommodations.
Eating will be difficult, but I have found some sleep already.
Bonnegrand shook his head as he walked before the captive. He peered over the beam for a closer look at Branson's midsection.
No blood yet. Impressive.
You could always walk behind me and pretend I'm one of your barnyard lovers.
Bonnegrand stared at him hatefully, then slapped him hard across the face.
This is no game, boy! Your life's hanging by a rope.
A chain, actually. Two.
And I hold the other end.
Then let it go and be done with me.
You pray that I'll make it easy for you.
You assume that I anticipate justice or fairness. I have learned to expect differently from Laird Bonnegrand.
Why have you come back to Pride? Why have you done this to me?
To you?
I warned you publicly that you could not return here until King Desolnik determined your innocence.
But you know I am innocent.
That matters not at all, and you know it.
But it should matter. And if it doesn't matter, then nothing does. Nothing. And nothing that you can do to me matters one bit.
Do not be assured of that.
Branson stared at him in response, his eyes flaring with intensity. He relaxed suddenly, allowing his weight to come forward onto his waist against the sword. A line of blood appeared on Branson's naked belly almost immediately, the sharp blade digging in. But Branson's expression didn't change. If he felt any pain at all, he didn't show it.
I am Jester too. My mind and body are one. I can deny pain, however much you choose to inflict. You cannot hurt me, Bonnegrand. You can slay me, but you cannot hurt me. I'll not let you.
You are mad. Ever were you a strange creature.
I am the Stork, remember? My whole life has been spent in misery. Or was, until I learned to dismiss the pain.
That easily?
That easily.
If you wish to rethink that challenge, then do so now. For I will succeed in making you cry out for mercy, I warn.
Branson didn't blink.
Fool.
Bonnegrand moved over to the wall where a table was set with various torture implements. Reviewing them carefully, he lifted a long, serrated blade.
You know the truth of it. You know that any torture you inflict upon me will harm you. Every cut to me will be a cut to Bonnegrand's soul.
You believe that I care at all for—
Yes. What were your words when first you walked in here?
Bonnegrand closed his eyes and rolled the blade over in his hands. Then he looked at Branson, and the young man knew, without doubt, that the game was over. Bonnegrand turned to him and lifted the blade and advanced. To kill him and be done with it and be done with him once and for all.
Laird Bonnegrand, I beg!
It is not your begging I seek, Riandu.
What is this horror?
None of your affair!
I protest!
Go back to your chapel!
No!
Bonnegrand looked at him threateningly.
Bonnegrand, Laird, I beg of you. This man has done nothing to deserve—
The same could be said of most men and women my age and all of Hans. Deserve? Have you been to the South, where all hint of society has been replaced by savagery? Where the weak are slaves to the strong, the women chattel to be taken by any man who so desires? Where every decency has been sublimated to every urge? Deserve? Do any of us deserve the hubris of Delavor, now the idiot Jeselnik, and of Ethelbert? Or do we all deserve it because it is not but a sad joke?
Branson?
You really do not care, do you? Would you grin as you died if I cut open your throat now?
The Bear of Haunt smiled wickedly as he asked the question, lifting the knife as he approached. Branson smiled back and made no move to resist or protest at all.
Spare him.
He must tell me everything he has learned. He has been to Ethelbert. He claims he knows who killed King Delavor. I will have every word.
And then you will spare him?
If his words please me, perhaps. But know that my patience is ended.
Your blade will do no more than set me free.
Branson, tell him. If you care not at all about anything as you claim, then what harm is there in telling Bonnegrand what he wishes to know? What sense is there in offering your life? What are you protecting?
Laird Delavor was murdered by a woman, of Bear. She is Hu Lei, and not Jester Tu.
Riandu and Bonagran look to each other in confusion.
Hu Lei, an older order than Jester Tu. With a philosophy that names a warrior as but an instrument, a mercenary. Her name is Afwen Wi. She leads a band of several followers. She broke her sword in King Delaval's chest and has claimed my sword as her own for replacement. If you fight her, Bonagran, she will kill you. So would Mirwal Yana, her escort, who is stronger but not as skilled.
Clouds of doubt cross Banagran's strong features.
I have fought them both, and have battled you more than once. Either would defeat you.
These are Ethelbert's assassins?
Who came out of the city in the dark of night and turned back Prince Milwellis's army.
Only a handful, though, you say?
One less, perhaps two less, by my hand.
Why would you fight them? Have you thrown in with King Yezelnik?
They disgust me. Ethelbert disgusts me. Yezelnik disgusts me, and you disgust me.
Branson!
You have ruined the world. You trample children under your march and do not care. You have destroyed all expressions of civilized life in the South. You bring misery to every man and woman of Hants and care not at all.
Branson, please!
You ask me to fly a pennant from my sword tip. You, all of you, demand that I choose a side. When I was young and at Chapel Pride, you might have asked me an equally relevant question, Master Riandu. You might have asked which chamber pot, which pail of shit and piss I preferred. The one hanging from my right hand or the one hanging from my left.
So Branson fights for no one except Branson, then?
Branson chooses not to fight at all. But should he have to, then yes.
I will march to war soon. Branson will march beside me.
The highwayman looked at him as if this statement were preposterous, as if the bear had lost his mind.
Because if you do, I will ensure that you and your family will live in Pride Town, and live well. Callan de Warne and her daughter will be welcomed back, and I will see to it that you are never in need again.
I am Jester Tu, not Hu Lei. I am no mercenary.
Why not? You will be doing no more than emptying chamber pots by your own words.
Nay. To do as you ask would be putting my skills against simple peasants pressed to service, who do not deserve my wrath.
Fight only this Afwen Wi creature, then, and her consort. Slay those who murdered King Delaval, and I am confident that King Yezelnik will forgive your every crime. He fears these assassins. It is why he fled the field before Ethelbert's gates. But now he is determined to return to the coastal city and be done with Ethelbert, and no doubt he will succeed. If in that process the highwayman rids him of the assassins he most fears, then his gratitude will lead to pardon. And in return, I will let you and your family live in Pride Town forevermore, as distinguished citizens in good standing. Choose your home among any standing, save Castle Pride itself, and I will grant it.
Branson made no move to answer, and his visage did not soften.
Or, if you truly care not for anything, you can die here in this miserable dungeon. Perhaps I will let you starve and rot here in the mud, then leave you for the rats to devour. Or I'll have my most trusted guards drag your rotting body out into the woods, perhaps to bury you where you'll never be found. Then I'll tell your lady that I know not what might have happened to you, and let her live her life in misery, ever watching for your return.
You would do exactly that, wouldn't you?
You claim that you do not care. But you know me, highwayman, and you know that I care even less. I must go and face Ethelbert again. I plan to survive the journey, and if your blade helps me to do that, then so be it. If you choose to be of no use to me, then you are of no use to me, and so I simply do not care for you.
Accept the deal, Branson. By blessed Abel, man, I came here seeing no hope for you. And now there is opportunity and hope. Perhaps you will help facilitate the end of this wretched war at the same time.
Branson's thoughts swirled. He had nothing to which he could attach them. No anchor, no reality. Bonagran had caught him completely off guard with the impromptu proposal. Was any of it possible? Was it possible that he would get his sword back? Or the brooch Father Otto Leven had entrusted to him? And would Bonagran hold true to his promise? Would this action facilitate a better life for Callan and Kaydale and for his child? His child. Branson found his anchor in that notion. His child. He silently berated himself for this surrender, for this willingness to see the end of his life. How selfish he had become in his despair.
How dare I?
How dare you? How dare you not? What wondrous gift I have just offered you, fool! I could kill you without question, here and now. Nay, I would be hailed as a hero to the throne for ending your life. And yet I offer you another way.
How do I know that you will be true to your word?
What do I have to gain by lying? If I cared whether you lived or died, you'd be long dead already.
But if I succeed, you would have me living in Pride Town.
Expect no invitations to dine at Castle Pride.
I will kill Afwin Wee and Mirwal Yana.
I will summon the jailer to free you of your chains.
Yezelnik will not be pleased.
Yezelnik is terrified of Ethelbert's assassins. He will be thrilled.
This brave and noble man you call king.
I beg you to forget it.
Father Destro spoke to Cormac and Milkayla.
For the sake of the wider world, leave your personal inquiries aside.
The man was a friend and an important part of Dame Gwydra's designs. Am I to simply believe that he is dead and care not for how that came about? Is there to be no value or justice or accountability to and for his death?
Oh, how many hundreds, thousands have died as such?
But he was here.
Yes, this man Branson, the man you call the Highwayman, was here in Ethelbert Dos Antal just a few weeks ago.
And now Afwin Wee carries his sword.
She had his sword when I was introduced to him, when she brought him before Laird Ethelbert. He was very much alive and well at that time, and yet Afwin Wee carried his sword as her own.
And the brooch on his forehead?
That is why I and my brethren were brought to the meeting. We carried sunstones to counter any dangerous or devious magic the Highwayman might have tried to initiate at Laird Ethelbert. You must understand that we did not know his allegiance at that time, if he had any.
Might Afwin Wee have possessed another soul stone, Father?
None of which I was aware. Laird Ethelbert holds a few stones of varied powers, a soul stone among them, I believe. But again, I warn you not to ask him and not to bring this conversation beyond these sheltered walls.
And Jameson Sequin? A tall man with a great mustache who favored the bow and a tri-cornered hat?
Forget it.
If Afwin Wee played a role in Branson's death,
then you and Dame Gwydra would be better off knowing nothing about it. Laird Ethelbert loves the woman. He will support her no matter her complicity in your friend's demise. And we do not even know that he is dead. More likely, Afwin Wee, who claimed him as a subordinate in her warrior band, sent him on some mission. Her followers are among the few scouts leaving the city of late. The eyes and ears of Laird Ethelbert, a most vital role. She would probably demand much of the Highwayman before accepting him fully into her elite band.
By the time King Yezelnik caught up with Prince Milwellis and the Palmaris Town garrison in the small town of Weathergard, down the long grassy hill from Chapel of Bell, the siege and assault preparations were already well underway. Lines of men bearing great logs streamed into the town, which now had far more invading soldiers living in tents than residents in more permanent structures. Huge piles of stones grew daily. Milwellis stood in the command tent before a large topographical map spread wide on a table. On the map were lines of models of the catapults and small carved markers to represent cavalry units and archer brigades.
Do not begin your bombardment of the fools until the harbor is secure.
My father's fleet will see to that presently.
His warships are in the gulf, yes. But beware, for it's the monks that determine that they must flee. They will go out in great numbers armed with their devilish gemstones. Before the weight of magical fire and lightning, even our greatest ships will prove vulnerable.
They will not get out of their harbor. They protect their docks with a narrow channel between high cliffs. There is but one approach between rocky reefs.
Still, one boat armed with the great magicians of the Order might break through the gauntlet.
They waited too long. You will see the value of your loyal subjects of Palmaris Town in the dawning light of tomorrow.
Yezelnik looked to Olim, who could only shrug.
We awaited your arrival. We did not feel it necessary to move with expedient since the monks and their visitors from Vanguard showed no apparent haste to be free from their walled prison. They hold to the notion that their chapel will withstand all that we can offer, and they may be correct.
But when the rest of the world, Vanguard included, bows to King Yezelnik, that security will seem like a prison.
You will leave here for Ethelbert City with all confidence that Palmaris Town controls the Gulf Coast and that your enemies will not escape Chapel Abel.
The king did not sleep well that night, but not for any lack of confidence that the plan was going along splendidly. He was agitated and excited by the surprise Milwellis had promised him, and so when the prince's man came to rouse him at first light, he was already awake and dressed. He and Queen Olim met with Milwellis on a bluff overlooking the dark gulf waters. Milwellis nodded to the left, where a large ship was just coming into view.
an old cargo barge, refitted with many tall sails and with great posts running deep below her, far below her keel.
The ship turned, making straight for the narrow approach to the gap between the high cliffs, 1,000 feet below the walls of the great chapel. Through that gap, unseen from this angle, sat the docks of Chapel Abel, accessible to the chapel complex high above only through long tunnels.
You're attacking by sea? How many warriors are aboard that ship?
None, and only a handful of crew.
Jeselnik looked at him curiously, but said no more. Instead, watching as the large ship passed from sight into the cliff gap. Almost immediately, there came the sharp retort of a Belican lightning, flashes of fire and bursts of thunderous magic as the monks defended their docks. Jeselnik did not know it, but the blast was self-inflicted on the ship, a blast calculated to take out her starboard hull just below the waterline.
The ship is sunk.
Jeselnik just stared at him for many heartbeats.
In the shallowest and narrowest part of the approach, where her wreckage will block the entrance or egress of any sizable boat. We reinforced every corner of the barge with thick metal. It'll take the monks weeks of difficult work to clear enough of the flotsam to have docks accessible to anything larger than a small road craft.
Brilliant! You've just freed many of our warships from the duties of blockade so that they may run wild along the Vanguard coast, or even all the way to Ethelbert Dosental, should I need them to finish that troublesome laird.
You have entrusted us with the most important duty of all. Dame Guaidra and Father Otto Levin will not escape Chapel Abel. They will exit only under a flag of surrender to King Jeselnik of Hontz.
Brother Pinauer found all the principals gathered in Father Otto Levin's quarters. The masters of St. Mirabel were there, along with Father Primujan of Vanguard's Chapel Pelinor, Dame Guaidra herself, and of course, Father Otto Levin. Pinauer slipped in quietly and took his seat off to the side of the leaders.
Their boldness speaks of desperation.
Uncoordinated. They did not employ archers to keep our brothers low on their cliff perches, nor did any catapults of other warships send forth their missiles.
The ship is stopped?
Exactly where our enemies wanted it to sink. It was no attack, but merely flotsam for a blockade.
Clever. The strait is blocked.
It was a large ship, and seems as if designed to sink at an angle. I doubt that any vessel of considerable size could cross in or out.
They try to seal us into a place from which we have no intention of leaving, and in doing so, they minimize their own avenues of attack.
They mean a long and full siege, then. This is not ill news. We have known from the moment of our proclamation of disloyalty to the claims of Jeselnik that our success rested upon the work of our emissaries to Laird Ethelbert. St. Mirabel stands as a solid monument of defiance, but our influence is limited beyond our walls.
I fear for the people of Vanguard. Would that I could go home to lead them in this dark time.
We will find a way. As I am confident that your man Dawson will find a way to get back to us with word from the south.
Brother Pinauer brought a hand to his mouth. He had an idea. There was no moon that night, and under the cover of darkness a handful of monks gathered on the docks of St. Mirabel. They each carried a malachite, the stone of levitation, and a graphite, a serpentine, and a ruby. A pair also held curved iron bars 2 feet in length, one end of each set with potent lodestones, the stone of magnetism, which were useful in pulling metal nails. They dropped their woolen robes and moved to the very end of the wharf.
Remember, do not disassemble it. We are merely inspecting the wreck, weakening it so that we can be rid of it in short order should the need arise to clear the strait.
Brother Pinauer, clad in only a loincloth, stood among them, malachite in hand and assorted other stones in a small pouch tied on one hip. He also carried a large backpack full of supplies and common clothing. Enacting their gemstones, the brothers stepped down to the water and walked upon it in single file. They made the wreck without incident and went to work, letting those with engineering expertise thoroughly examine the craft. Pinauer stayed with them for a short while, for he, the most versed in gemstones, knew the potential trouble of enacting magic underwater. A graphite, for example, might throw a line of lightning across a field. But underwater, it would more likely produce a globe of energy that could easily sting, stun, or even kill a careless user. The team worked with typical monkish discipline, the engineers pointing out critical joints and support planks that could be removed, and the monks diving to the spots to loosen nails and pegs. Using clever teamwork, they managed to utilize a serpentine shield that allowed them to isolate areas of wood that could then be scorched with the magical fire of rubies.
Are you certain that you should venture forth this night?
A monk spoke to Pinaur as they stood together on the water near one of the protruding and angled masts.
Our flashes are muted by the waves, but some are visible nonetheless, and light carries far across dark waters.
I will find my way safely. Now is the time for men to step forward bravely, as Father Otto Leven has done in defying Yezelnik. He has chosen principle over expedience and has reminded us that there are bigger things than these corporeal, mortal bodies. On my first day at Chapel Abel, St. Mir Abel, those many years ago, the inducting brother bade us to consider our physical form as no more than a wagon carting us along a road much longer than this lifespan in this world. The secret, he said, is to leave this leg of our eternal journey with our hearts pure, integrity intact, principle over expedience, brother, and let the consequences be accepted as they fall, as we can only control that which is in our hearts. Father de Gilum chose expedience. Since Yezelnik appears so near to victory, he reasoned that the Order should accede to his demands and offer fealty. To Father de Gilum's thinking, we could thrive under King Yezelnik. But Father Otto Leven knows better and understands the truth of who we are and why we are here. He chooses the way of principle. I have never been more proud of our order, and my only fear as I venture forth is not for me, but for those I would leave behind should I fail in this task.
You'll not fail, brother. You walk with Blessed Abel. Your steps are sure, because you know they are upon the right road.
Pinaur was glad for those words. He smiled in reply and patted the younger monk on the shoulder. Then he splashed his foot upon the water.
Even if that road is the surface of the sea.
And with that, Brother Pinaur jogged away from the brother and the shipwreck, straight for the southern coast of the Gulf of Corona, moving east of St. Mirabel. He knew that he would have to cover many miles before finding an accessible beach, and he knew, too, that the distant beach would be only the beginning of his journey. The first of Milwellis's catapults let fly the next morning, throwing a huge stone to the field just before the towering stone walls of St. Mirabel. Dame Guaidra walked resolutely across the courtyard, a lone figure, tall and thin, with her light brown hair cut short and fashionable, and a smart but simple wrap pulled tight around her. Around her, the monks and the attendants, who were mostly former prisoners of one side or the other in the ongoing war, rushed to and fro, calling out orders and crying for everyone to take cover. She walked to the parapet ladder and gathered her wrap to free her legs. Again, the woman didn't flinch as she climbed to the parapet. She looked out over the long, sloping field toward Weathergard, shielding her eyes so she could better discern the line of catapults.
Dame, I beg of you, seek cover!
Only a coward would throw from afar. I do not fear cowards, brother.
The man straightened his shoulders and returned her smile. From him emanated the same sense of calm that became infectious about the courtyard. The brothers and attendants went about their chores with rocks arching through the air, setting watches along the wall, calling shots and yelling to those in an area of imminent peril. Dame Guaidra spent most of the morning on the wall, even placing a few bets with the brothers, until Father Primujan scrambled up the ladder behind her.
Otto Leven is not well this day. He will likely not rise from his bed.
Has he named anyone to speak in his stead?
Brother Pinaur is out to the east. Brother Jurgian, perhaps?
Has Otto Leven named a successor?
Dame, he is not dying.
We are all dying, Father. He should name a successor.
Fathers of the Order are selected by committee, not as an inheritance.
I know. And I know, too, that such a gathering of leaders could not be brought about easily.
Dame!
Primujan grabbed her and tried to pull her aside.
I win! I do make such an inviting target.
Lady?
Dame Guaidra walked by him to the ladder and started down.
Gather the masters. Let us dine together this day.
Where are you going?
To speak with Father Otto Leven.
The dame caught up with Primujan and the other monks, all the masters of St. Mirabel, as the meal was being set out in the chapel complex's great dining hall. She waited for the attendants to finish bringing the food and drink before standing at the center of the long table and lifting her flagon in toast.
I have spoken with Father Otto Leven. He is well. Let us toast to his continued health.
The monks nodded and drank, and more than a few started to sit once more, but Dame Guaidra remained standing and kept her flagon high.
But in the event that his health should worsen, Father Otto Leven has named a successor, a steward to the leadership of the Order of Blessed Abel. Should God take him from us, Father Primujan of Vanguard will steward the chapel and the order.
Dame Guaidra looked to Father Primujan. The man fidgeted and seemed quite out of sorts. But in the end, he smiled back at her and joined in her toast. Dame Guaidra had facilitated this. They all knew it. She had gone from the wall to Father Arto Levin's bedroom and had demanded that he name a successor and that the successor be the man of her choosing, the father from Vanguard, whom she had known and trusted for many years. When Father Primujan asked, accused actually, Guaidra of this after the dinner, the woman didn't deny her role in the least.
He needed the responsibility lifted from his old shoulders. And I needed someone in place who would remain strong through the trying days ahead. I needed you, Primujan, a fellow of Vanguard, who has known great hardship and who will not flinch when King Yeselnik comes calling.
Father Arto Levin, confident in Guaidra and their mutual selection of Primujan, rested very well that night, sleeping more peacefully than he had in years since the war between Ethelbert and Delaval had commenced. He died quietly the next morning.
And so our young hero has found a cause.
Master Riandu spoke to Branson when the highwaymen ventured to Chapel Pride later that same day.
Branson will fight for Branson. I'm surprised that you did not bargain harder with Bornegran. Perhaps you might have added some gold to the purse for your services.
Branson continued to stare at the man to try to take a measure of this sudden change. Hadn't Riandu begged him to accept the deal offered by Bornegran? And now he seemed quite perturbed that Branson had done exactly that. They locked stares for some time.
Are you angry with me, Brother Riandu? Or with yourself?
With both. Oh, and with all the world.
A few hours ago you bade me accept the deal and be done with this war. What has changed?
In helping Bornegran, you aid Yeselnik.
Yeselnik or Ethelbert, they are one and the same, equally worthless.
But Riandu shook his head slowly and deliberately.
What has changed?
King Yeselnik's advance guard came in this day. The king is not far behind. King Yeselnik has declared war against Saint Mirabel.
Saint Mirabel?
Abel has been declared a saint by word of Father Arteleven and the masters. And so the chapel has been renamed in deference to Abel's holy station. With the declaration has come a determination of defiance against King Yeselnik, and he, in turn, has declared the church outlaw. Do you know Father de Gilbe? Then you do.
He has brought trouble. That is no surprise.
He will arrive here with King Yeselnik in the morning, so if King Yeselnik has declared the church outlawed, and yet Father de Gilbe travels with him...
Then de Gilbe is now outside the order.
The church of... the Divine King.
No, the Order. Your Order is now led by de Gilbe and not Arto Leven. So it does matter to you now which side proves victorious. Before, you were interested merely in ending the war, but now the stakes have been raised. Now it has become a personal trial from Master Riandu. Do you wish to recant your advice to me, your humble servant? Should I betray Bornegran and flee to Ethelbert's flag? Or should I simply surrender to Bornegran once more? And go back to his chains and blades.
No, of course not. No, Branson. My advice to you would not have changed.
But you do not wish Yeselnik to win. When the war was merely about the torn flesh of peasants, Riandu cared less. But now, over some silly allegiance to a sainted dead man in a meaningless church, Riandu has come to care.
I always care, Branson. Always did I wish to alleviate the suffering.
If the war was declared over this very day, Yeselnik the victor, de Gilbe the new religious head of Hans, would Riandu accept the verdict?
I would not have advised you differently, even had I known the escalation of enmity between St. Mirabel and King Yeselnik. My duty is to advise you to do that which is best for you and your family. I would not have Branson executed by Bornegran before King Yeselnik's throne, nor would I demand of you that you find in this war a higher context and mission.
Even as you are faced with exactly that.
Perhaps. I see no clear path before me, but I will seek the correct road for myself and for those who look to me for guidance.
De Gilbe or Arto Leven? Hardly a difficult choice.
What do you know?
The Gilb is a wretch.
I know that he went to Alpinador at the request of Father Artelevan,
where he imprisoned those who had not bend to his demands of conversion, and warred with those who came to rescue their imprisoned brethren, murdering them at the base of his fortress walls. Do you think that a proper use of the holy gemstones? And when one of the brothers in his charge could not stand the needless bloodshed any longer, and thus freed the captured Alpinadorans, bringing peace to the island, De Gilb ordered the monk beaten unconscious and cast out in a boat to die. But he did not die. Indeed, he rescued me in the cold north, and that man, that monk Cormac, is of great character and conscience, a man your order should revere and not torture. I was in the north at the demand of Dame Guaidra of Vanguard.
Yes, to battle ancient Baldan. The details have come to Chapel Pride. Your exploits were no small matter to the Order of Blessed Abel, I assure you.
And when I went to battle ancient Baldan, I went with many allies, including the monk De Gilb had cast out to die. But De Gilb was not beside me, nor were any of those under his command. Nay, he had fled the field.
Riandu stared at him.
And when Dame Guaidra pardoned the monk De Gilb had banished, and when Father Primujan of Chapel Pelennor supported her edict, so began the battle between Church and Father De Gilb. In Chapel, Saint Mere Abel, Father Artelevan too opposed De Gilb strongly.
And you believe that his defection to Yeselnik is self-serving, and not necessarily rooted in the call of his conscience?
It is rooted in his wounded pride. And nothing more, unless it is his realization that his actions have cost him the succession of old Artelevan's seat.
You are not pleased with Yeselnik's choice of De Gilb, and never were you pleased with Yeselnik himself, as I recall. Has this news given you pause over your agreement with the Pontagran? Will you betray him and simply run away?
No, for I have seen the alternative, Laird Ethelbert, and am no more impressed by him. My fight is personal with Afwin Wee. She stole my sword and the star brooch Father Artelevan entrusted with me. I ride with Bonagran, but care nothing for the larger questions of the day. There is no right and wrong to be found there in my heart.
I don't believe you.
Branson started to rebut the monk, but held his tongue. Something about the manner in which Riandu was looking at him told him the truth of the monk's accusation. Riandu didn't believe him, because Riandu expected more of him.
I'll not betray Bonagran. My fight is with Afwin Wee. Your own choice is more important to the ways of the world.
Many look to the highwayman with hope.
Your order is fractured and is choosing sides. The highwayman is but one man. The highwayman is but one dead man killed in the east by warriors from Bear.